My love, she speaks like silence, without ideals or violence.
Welcome to After Hours. That's Joan Baez singing the songs of her former lover, Bob Dylan. And I thought it was, I didn't think it was appropriate for the show. I just like the music of both of them. It is my great pleasure to have in here two old friends who've done the show a number of times. Not maybe for every one of their dozen or so books that they put together, but plenty of time. Rich Cahan, my former colleague at the Chicago Sun-Times, and Michael Williams have... Publishers are not generally greatly admired, but these two men are as admirable and passionate about the business of book publishing as any two people I know, and I mean that. It is... You produce these magnificent books, the latest of which we'll talk about tonight, Chicago Classic Portraits. There is, as we were saying 3 minutes ago, there's a surprise and a revelation on every single page of this. Remind me, though, and you do remind people in the introduction, you met when Michael walked in the Sun-Times in 1987.
Right. Thank you, Rick, very much. I was a picture editor at the Chicago Sun-Times, and Mike was a photographer. And he walked in with photographs that he had taken of the Granada Theater as it was being torn down. He was in the interior and had beautiful photographs. We rejected the pictures, right?
No, you picked out a really good one and you published them. But the real magical thing about that day was I was like 21 years old in college. And I loved photography and I loved the newspaper business. And Rich took me up and down all over that old building. He took me into the picture archive. He took me over to Cupp's desk. He took me to Roger Ebert's desk. He showed me the whole place. And the most important thing was he showed me that photo morgue.
It was amazing.
It reeked of Fixer and old paper. And, you know, of course, that experience really kind of catapulted me into, you know, what I'm doing now. So it was a fateful day.
How did the publishing start?
Well, Rick, you probably...
Because I find the seed of this latest book, Chicago Classic Photographs, very interesting. But how did the entire publishing adventure start?
Well, my wife and I were owners of City Files Books, a bookstore that you used to promote quite a bit.
Yes, which I loved.
People loved it. And Mike was a customer of ours. And I hated every minute of everyone wants to run an art gallery and a bookstore in their life, and I got it all out of my system in 14 months. And Mike had done work. He had written books on Rogers Park, and he said, let's do a book together. And the moment the store closed, we started working, and that was 2003, and we've done a book every year since then.
So it's 13. Is this your 13th, would you say?
13th or 14th.
Yeah, sounds right. Yeah,
sounds
right. There are such other titles. I have them all here somewhere. The book about Edgar Miller is unbelievable. The Gotta Go, Gotta Flow, which combines the words of our former colleague Patricia Smith, right, the noted poet, and the work of a guy named Michael Abramson, who I knew a bit before he died.
You were the first person to write about him.
One of the interesting things about that, and the same thing is true of this Chicago Classic Photographs, is photographers, especially newspaper photographers, are, I think, the most anonymous artists making art.
That's true. Like, we had this great fortune to go through the Sun-Times archive to do two books, and we went through probably easily a million pictures and negatives. And when you go through that much work, all these decades and decades of work, you start to see patterns emerge among photographers. And there were guys there who really were artists. The guy who comes to my mind is Bill Sturm, who worked at the Sun-Times. And he was one of these guys who, if it was the last of something, he was the guy there. And he would capture the last steam train pulling out of Union Station or the last horse and buggy coming out of Maxwell Street. So that's kind of where this book came from. It was getting to know the archives really well in Chicago and seeing all these pictures and kind of in the back of our minds putting together this list of, if we ever do a book that's kind of a collection of the greatest Chicago photographs.
You're right in the lovely introduction to this book about the one photo that kind of sparked this book, this Jonas Davidatis portrait of a guy sitting. Describe it. It's on page 161.
Yeah, Jonas was assigned to document the building of the antenna at the John Hancock building, and he spent 6 months at the building, and there was this one moment where he takes this picture of an iron worker, and it's above his head, and you can see the whole city laid out below him. And we were actually driving one day, and we together thought that was the most classic photograph that was ever taken of Chicago. And as we were arguing about it, we said, well, let's find all the classic photographs that were taken. And so this is not, you know, what I think makes this book so unusual is a combination of fine art photographers, commercial photographers, newspaper photographers, and even students, things that we've fallen in love with
and
over the years.
Unknown.
I mean,
some of the – there literally is, ladies and gentlemen, you can get this book anywhere, but better to go get it at cityfilespress.com because it will be sent to you – free of mailing charges, and it will be autographed by these fine, passionate publishers.
And it will help keep us going.
Yes, and it's good. It helps support. This is not a cheap endeavor that you guys do because of the quality of the paper and the quality of the prints. Talking about provocative surprises, the page following Jonas Davidanis's famous, iconic shot is of Diane Joy Schmidt.
Yes.
Describe that photo, if you will.
Well, it's a picture of a woman naked, Michelle Fitzgerald, and she's looking out over. She's looking out inside a building at the Wrigley Building.
At the clock, yeah.
And Diane and Michelle combined in the 1980s to create something called the Chicago Exhibition. And Michelle posed naked, nude, all over Chicago, sometimes in front of the St. Patrick's Day Parade. And she would open up her little coat. And they were just, let's say they're grab shots. And they're really beautiful. They say a lot about women, and they say a lot about Chicago, and they're really fun.
Define both of you, Rich Cahan and Michael Williams. You first, Michael. Define classic for me.
Boy, that's we've had this argument.
Oh, I'll bet.
Over the last
discussion. I'll bet.
I'll tell you, I think this is how I looked at it. We kind of came up with a list of photographers and images on a long drive to the National Archives, and we probably put together a list of 100, 150 photographers and great photographs. And the one rule in doing the book was that there really would be no rules. You could have an anonymous photographer next to Walker Evans. You could have Dorothea Lange next to a found photograph. And it didn't matter who took it, but you kind of know it when it's a classic. It's one of those kinds of things. So we didn't want to be limited at all to just the greatest photographers. We wanted to be just limited to really great photographs. And I'm really proud that all these different kind of areas of photography are represented, but somehow in the sum of it all, they transcend a group of pictures to really tell this story. And I think that was really the measure of if it made it or not, if it kind of somehow – there's a narrative to the book.
No question.
It's kind of hard to pick it up at first.
I agree.
But somehow architectural photographs and found photographs and newspaper photographs
Skid Row photographs. Yeah. There is no Skid Row anymore.
Right. But it was an important part of the city.
No question. And it was an appealing part of the city to – not just photographers, to writers
Absolutely.
As well.
Absolutely. And I think that these are like in the basic word of classic. These are pictures that could have been taken 80, 90 years ago, but they still have an impact. I think they're all eye-popping photographs, and I think that they all contribute to show what it's like to live in Chicago. I think when you finish this book, you really, not just because we have Riverview and the L, but there's a sense of life that these photographs really portray.
Yeah, that's well put. That's well put. We'll take a break and come back and continue on with these fine people. Again, you can go to cityfilespress.com to buy Chicago Classic Photographs, but also there are many other books. We'll try to talk a little about some of the others, including the one Richard Nickel, who I kind of grew up knowing. I played with his kids because he lived nearby. He has some very surprising shots in here because you really think of Richard as a architectural photographer or a activist photographer, and he has some amazing portraits in here. We'll be right back.
You must leave now, take what you need, you think will last.
Ben Baez and Bob Dylan singing. Rich Gahan and Michael Williams talking to me about their fantastic new book, Chicago Classic Photographs. And I must tell you, there's no publishing house in this country that has published as consistently wonderful books as these two. All you need to do is go to cityfilespress.com and to buy this and to see the other books. You might be taken with Richard Nickel. You might be taken with Chicago City on the Move. You might be taken with Edgar Miller. You know, you guys have a way of finding people who need to be celebrated. That is my theory. Jack Delano traveled to Chicago, I'm reading from the book, to document the railroad industry for the Office of War Information. If he never took another picture, the picture he took of a Pullman porter on page 65 in this book is among the greatest photographs I've ever seen. I need to ask you both, what, because you know much more about it than I, what makes a great photograph? I know this is another let's talk for 5 hours kind
yeah,
of thing.
But. Yeah, what makes people funny? It's such a hard question.
Yeah, right.
It's people that have a way. Mike, you.
maybe it's just the intensity of the visceral reaction of the people, of the person looking at the photograph. Maybe it's as simple as that.
Yeah, I think for me, it's pictures that kind of provoke an emotional reaction. And it's hard to say what makes that. I know when I was studying photography, I used to go to the Columbia College Library and every day and fill up a cart with books and just look at them and try to understand what makes a good photograph. And it's only through looking at lots of photographs and taking lots of photographs that you're able to kind of develop those instincts. I don't think you can tell somebody how to take a good picture and have them go out.
Well, see, but I trust you two because you have seen collectively millions. Not exaggerating. No coke and
hyperbole. That's last week alone.
Huh?
That's last week alone.
Tens of millions of photographs. And some grab you, some don't. But you sort of...
We know it among ourselves, between ourselves. We don't usually talk about what makes it great. We just know immediately. And we argue. I mean, this book has 225 photographs, and there must be 500 that almost made it.
I tell you that the important thing about this book was we were trying to tell a story here. Actually, a lot of little short stories.
Yeah.
And it's really sometimes the combination and the sequence that makes a photograph important.
Right.
So there was a lot of really good photographs that we didn't use because they didn't further the story that we were
trying
to tell.
Right, and kind of inspired by Ben Hecht and his 1001 Afternoons.
Yes, we absolutely were.
And many, many, as we said before, famous photographers and many incredible surprises like – for instance, Stanley Kubrick has a photograph in here, the famous film director.
He was about 20 years old, and he was a look photographer before he became a film, before he got involved with films. And what a portfolio he put together on Chicago. We ended up using one photo of a wrestling match, but it's spectacular.
And yeah, it's a great, great, great photo. A lot of the majority of the photographers, of course, men. Because, except with the exception of, you know, Barbara Crane and some others. Talk to me about that. I know that boy, I don't ever – I remember meeting a female photographer at a newspaper when I was in my maybe 20s, maybe 30s. But that was not a woman's racket, was it, Rich?
Well, it wasn't, but there's some spectacular photographers. You know, certainly Vivian Maier, who we've written books about, was the most extraordinary, not women photographer, along with Dorothea Lange. But also we're huge fans of Esther Bubbly, who was actually born in Wisconsin, spent most of her years in New York City, but produced beautiful work in Chicago. And there's a woman, Angie McMonagle, who's alive now and who's taking pictures now. So that tradition has continued through the years.
I think Mildred Mead was a real discovery too. This is a woman who kind of went out on her own documenting the South Side, different neighborhoods. This is at a time when it was kind of unusual for a woman to be going out in the 50s photographing dilapidated buildings and neighborhoods in crisis.
See, one of the things about this book, Chicago Classic Photographs, if you spend enough time, and I'm not saying you need to spend a half hour with each photograph, if you spend enough time with each photograph, you will be drawn back to, if you have an imagination, I hope all of you do, to the time and place where these people took some of these photographs and trying to imagine that a photographer was not, you know, it's not the iPhone world, ladies and gentlemen. This was a different kind of thing. And some of Art Shea's photographs of, you know, kids in poor circumstances are remarkable to me. Art Shea being, you know, still active into his 90s here and a famous photographer.
I'm so glad you mentioned Art. I think he is the dean or the king of Chicago photography over the years. He spent time with Nelson Algren, and Art went on his personal wild ride through Chicago and photographed heroin addicts and photographed life, brought in photographically the world that we couldn't see. Barbara Crane, too, the queen of photography. Such curiosity. She has spent her life, and still is, she's in her 90s, photographing the city and photographing everything that's around her. It's
talk to me about what compelled people in we live in such a different photographic world now where everybody's a photographer. What compelled even you, Michael, as a young man, to pick up a camera? What was it? To tell a story? To capture life?
This is a really great question. We have so many great photographers in this book, and I think each one has got a different story. But I know for myself, and I think I can speak for a lot of photo people, is that this is the way we look at the world. We look at the world through, if we're not taking pictures, we're organizing pictures, or we're somehow trying to tell stories with pictures. And I think it starts with the photographers who, like Michael Abramson, who was compelled to go to these Southside clubs and document this. There's Mildred Mead, who was compelled to kind of document these kind of lost neighborhoods. Richard Nickel, who was compelled to document the work of Adler and Sullivan. It's interesting. In a way, they're kind of like preservationists. They're not saving buildings, but they're kind of saving these little niches, these little places.
Well, in that way, they're also like writers.
Yes. Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. And do you agree?
Absolutely. I think most of us really understand the world through photographs. We understand the Vietnam War through my life pictures and the pictures that brought us there. We understand Afghanistan through photos and some video. But what they're capturing more than anything else is the moment that can't be caught even a second later.
Yeah.
And that's like catching butterflies. It's spectacular.
Let's talk before we take a break, and you guys are going to stay until a quarter two. Yun Fujita, who I just encountered through a show at the Poetry Foundation. This guy was a revelation to me. I cannot even imagine what this guy went through. He was a Japanese
American, right?
And took among the most iconic photographs ever taken of the St. Valentine's Day Massacre, immediately in the wake of it. This is a unbelievably great picture,
cool picture
on page 226 and 27. Talk about him for a second.
Well, he was a poet with a camera. He loved to take pictures. He loved to write poetry and take pictures of flowers. But he actually also took what I think is the most important photojournalistic photo ever taken in the city. It's the picture of the Eastland disaster.
Yep.
And the boat is capsized and he's there. But again, he comes back to St. Valentine's Day Massacre and took beautiful pictures. And he's got a grandson by the name of Graham Lee, who is helping continue his grandfather's legacy.
And with a book.
With a book.
Yeah.
But we fell in love with this picture of the South Side, which shows it shows South Shore Drive at night, and it shows the hotels on the South Side near Hyde Park. And it's really a beautiful picture. You know, the South Side so often is ignored.
Oh.
And it was our pleasure to put lots of pictures of the South Side.
But in getting to know some of whom, Fujita died in 1963, but you two, Michael Williams and Rich Cahan, you know these people.
Well, we know a lot of them.
You know in a kind of visceral way, I think, a great deal about these photographers.
You know, what's interesting, too, is there's a lot of living photographers, but there's a lot of photographers we only know through their work now. They've died. And we've had this like wonderful opportunity to get to know them through their work and through studying their archives. I think of Don Bronstein, who we had this great privilege of going through his work. He was the Chess Records official photographer.
Yeah, first Playboy.
Yeah. And there's these amazing archives in this city. I think you can't understate that enough, how special Chicago is, a town for photography.
Well, we'll pursue that after the news. I'm talking to Richard Cahan and Michael Williams about their latest book, Chicago Classic Photographs. You owe it to yourself, if you care anything about Chicago, to go to cityfilespress.com to order this book and take a look at the others, because I guarantee you'll order more than one. This is Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago and WGNradio.com. Here with the news brought to you by RiverboatTwilight.com is David Jennings.
An 18-year-old man gunned down this afternoon on the 100 block of North Parkside Avenue. CPD say three men were wounded by gunfire and in another shooting at the same location last night. The UN Security Council Tuesday is expected to have a chat about today's medium-range ballistic missile launch by North Korea. And Skokie police have identified the man found shot to death in a garage at Old Orchard Mall. He's a 34-year-old Chicago man. Detectives say they don't think he was a victim of random gun violence. Sports, traffic, and weather next on WGN.
Hi, this is Simone Biles. When kids believe in themselves, it's amazing what they can accomplish.
I believe I could be a pilot.
I believe I can be a professor.
A doctor.
A poet.
I believed I could be a gold medalist. And thanks to the love and support from my parents who adopted me when I was a foster kid, I was able to reach my dreams.
There are 400,000 foster kids in the U.S., many of whom have outgrown their old clothes. That's why Mattress Firm Foster Kids, a program of the Ticket to Dream Foundation, is collecting new clothes. With your donation, you can help foster kids in your community look and feel their best. To learn more or donate, visit mattressfirmfosterkids.org today.
I believe I could be anything.
Come to any Mattress Firm store today and donate clothes to help a foster child in your community. Not everyone can be a foster parent, but anyone can help a foster child.
People who can afford a LASIK procedure sure are lucky. Imagine being able to throw away your contacts and glasses. Imagine waking up tomorrow with 20/20 vision. Too bad everyone can't afford LASIK. Well, guess what? There's a company that agrees with you. The LASIK Vision Institute is now offering dramatically low prices on high-quality LASIK to make it affordable for everyone. That means you get the latest FDA-approved LASIK technology for a fraction of what others charge. And if you call right now, we'll schedule a free appointment so you can discover if LASIK is right for you. Results may vary. Call 1-800-600-5701. Even better, call right now and you can get an extra 20% discount off our already low-cost services. We've already performed over a million procedures. Let us help you. Discover how you can get the quality LASIK experience you deserve at a fraction of what others charge. For your free appointment, call 1-800-600-5701. 1-800-600-5701. 1-800-600-5701.
WGN Sports, the White Sox beat the Mariners today, 8-1. Sox now head to Arizona. They open a three-game set with the Diamondbacks tomorrow night. Cubs won the rubber game of the series with the Brewers at Wrigley 13-6 this afternoon. The Giants come in next. They open up a four-game set tomorrow. The NHL playoffs, Pittsburgh over Ottawa 7-0. The WNBA, the Sky beat Atlanta 75-71. WGN traffic, we have no major delays on any of the area's expressways and tollways. For traffic on the 7s or 8s or any time on demand, get the Traffic's Chicago app, pre-approved by Acunet Mortgage. Just search your app store for TRAFFIX Chicago. The forecast from the WGN Chicago Weather Center, clearing skies, 49 overnight, sunny, showers, thunderstorms starting in the afternoon tomorrow, 69, cloudy, a chance of showers and thunderstorms tomorrow night, dropping to 56. Cloudy, showers likely Tuesday and a high near 66 degrees. Cloudy and 51 at O'Hare, 52 Midway, 54 in Gary. The barometer, 30 inches of mercury and rising. It is 52 at the lakefront. Get Chicago news at the top of every hour. I'm David Jennings on Chicago's very own 720 WGN.
Adam Phillips doing his genius work engineering the show today. Joan Baez singing the words of Bob Dylan. I have a few more minutes with Rich Cahan and Michael Williams, two great friends of mine who I my admiration for them. Anybody who's in the book publishing business, you think first, well, you're nuts. So you have sympathy for them. But my admiration for the kind of books they produce at their City Files Press is limitless. The latest Chicago classic photographs. Whose is this cover shot?
It's Gordon Koster, who is something of a find. He was a very big deal in the 30s, but by the 1950s, he had lost his job in journalism, and he was actually working as a salesman for Weebolts. And the cover shot is a beautiful picture from 1938 of fireworks over the water tower. It's the perfect black and white picture. And it was found on the his son, Peter Koster, lives in LaGrange, and we went down to LaGrange to talk to him. And he had eight beautiful prints from his father on the walls. That's all he really had. And Mike, we took the pictures down and we scanned them. We took them out of the frame. We scanned them and put them back in the frame and put them back on the wall. And he was an important, great photographer.
Yeah, no kidding. This cover shot is unbelievable.
He was kind of producing photographs during this pictorialist period where it kind of shows Chicago and these deep, dark nights with brilliant illumination on things, and they kind of captured the city at that time beautifully.
Well, I think one of the great things about this book is there's nothing nostalgic about it. I find it, and I told you before you came on that this book has really moved me. It's as if the past has come, you know, shooting into my brain through these photographs, and it's not.
Thank you.
Nostalgia and like, oh, look how cute, look what that woman's wearing, and look at the guys in their strange coats and ties. It is of the moment. Am I making too much of this?
I hope not.
Well, can you explain this feeling
to
me?
We certainly put all this into it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's what we were trying to do, is to kind of put this portrait together of the city that is always changing and evolving, but there are these kind of root things about the city that don't change.
Yeah.
It's like the water towers and the L structure and
People moving. And
people moving.
The action and the energy.
Yeah, and people jumping and people staring at the camera. What's going to happen to some of these photographs and photographers? Not everybody gets the Vivian Meyer treatment or the, you know, gallery. Not all these people are going to be purchased and saved.
Yeah, we worry a lot about that. We hope that one day there'll be some kind of Chicago photography collective where people can take their negatives and leave them. We've talked about this for years. It's a big project. We don't exactly know how to do it. If anyone has ideas and want to join us, we'd be very interested, because these photographers in this book spent their lives documenting Chicago. These were not Johnny-come-latelys.
Right.
And this was their life, and they produced important, both artistic and historical work. And many of them, when they die, their work gets shoveled out, and we can't see them, and somebody has to save it.
You know, I wonder, you know, you were involved in City 2000.
Right.
And they have a huge, I guess they still have it at
the
University of Illinois. And I guess it would be possible for somebody to start archiving all of this work, these millions and millions of photographs of which you guys make beautiful books. And I suppose if the economics were different, you could produce a book, you know, every 5 months if you felt like it.
Right. This is really the tip of the iceberg. The work is really important.
Exactly.
And an institution, we really encourage an institution to step up and try to save this work. And we'd love to be a part of that.
Yeah, I think the call to action was really when the Chicago Sun-Times collection was sold. And when that, you know, that made up the old Chicago Sun and the Times and the Daily News. And you're talking millions of pictures that documented this city for, you know, almost
100
years.
Where did that go?
It went to eBay. It went to an outfit that scanned the images for the Sun-Times, which is great because they have digital copies. But the actual hard copies have just been sold on eBay, and they're kind of out there in the world. And it's, I think, using that as an example, these private collections are kind of looking for a home as well. And I think that if this was New York, I think a lot of these collections would be a lot, you know, valued more than they are. But for some reason, Chicago just can't take care of its own. It really needs a patron to put a little money into this right. and to save this stuff while it's still savable before it kind of gets broken up and sold in pieces.
Right. And I should say that Chicago History Museum was very helpful for us, to us, and they have great collections. This is expensive. Saving this, archiving it, digitizing is very expensive. I think they have a lot of interest in continuing this work, but they or any other institution really needs money to do it.
Well, you guys have been at this for 12, 13,
well, really, 14, our lives.
14 years. I know you've been at the passion for this, but the publishing game being what it is, this is a – you both understand, and I'm sure your significant others understand that this is a labor of love. This is not – no one's getting rich off this.
No, but we're getting rich over the experiences. The fact that we're able to find this material and meet these people make us very rich.
So you're going to carry on.
Oh, absolutely. We've got a long list of projects ahead of us.
Yeah, do you really?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
That's great. City Files Press is I love the store, but it's a great thing that it turned
Best thing
into.
That ever happened in the store was meeting Michael and starting this press.
Huh?
Yes.
Chicago classic photographs. Do you have – I'm going to ask you before I let you go. Sure. Do you each have a favorite in here, or is that impossible?
Well, the first five pages of the book I think are my favorites. It's Chicago in silhouette, taken by Howard Lyons. He went out and kind of overexposed these pictures to create these wonderful abstractions that really capture, me, what is the essence of the city that we know and love, and that's the water towers and the L uprights. These are all distinctly Chicago things. They can't be any other city. And I love the way the book kind of opens up with these things. I think true Chicagoans will love those. Even though they're in silhouette, people will recognize these shapes. And I think it really kind of pushes the boat off the shore beautifully.
Well, after you people have bought the book, I want you to email me, rcogan@chicagotribune.com, to tell me how much you enjoyed it.
Oh, thank you.
Because I think you will. And I know so many listeners of this show are you know, love Chicago as much as I do and as much as Michael Williams does and as much as Rich Cahan does. Rich, you have a favorite picture in here?
I'm the dad who loves it all, and I really do love every picture in the book. There's not a picture that I think I would break my heart if any of these 225 were taken.
And one of the great things for me was there was and I flipped through it as I always do it with a photo book at first. I don't flip through it. I go page by page by page
right.
by page. And there was something that grabbed me on every page, and I had to move on until I had the time to go back and linger.
And we did, tell the story behind every photograph. And
you
every
do
photographer.
Of the photographer and everything. Carry on, you guys. City Files Press. You can have the book autographed.
Absolutely.
You can have the book autographed. We're going to take a break, and then Lise Graham will do her thing in here. Welcome back. We're not bumping because we're going to talk music. As you know, those of you who've been listening for the last 3 weeks, and she's moving fast, Lise Graham, the new producer of this show, is a terribly bright and enthusiastic and passionate young woman who has a number of interests, mostly in the arts. And so she started, I think the first week she was here, she started her own podcast. Then she did another podcast, and she said, Rick, I've interviewed this very nice band, and I'm paraphrasing. This was on email. I mean, very nice band, and they play good music, and they'd love to come on the show. And I said, well, good. You can interview them when they come on the show. First, let me hear their song, and I love the song. So, Lise, your show.
Here we are. So, it's funny because...
This is not a podcast. This
no,
is live.
This is, okay. So, no profanities. Got that? All right.
I already cleared that up.
Hello, Ben. This is Ben Montalbano.
Hello.
He is the main guy in this awesome band called Mateus, who I actually was honored to be in the presence of at their first ever live show at Shuba's last year.
Why were you there?
Why were you there?
Did you just hear about the band, or did you go to the same college, or did you have mutual friends, or...
Yeah, mutual friends.
Okay.
A good friend of mine, Joe Mieland, if he's listening, hi Joe, is in the band. He plays keys and sings harmony. And
does a lot of writing as well.
Yeah, and a couple other guys from college. So, you know, Champaign-Urbana music scene is all very interlaced. So if you know some of the musicians, you know all of them. Mm-hmm. And it's great, and they're all really talented. So,
well, no, that's impossible. They can't all be really talented. There got to be some losers in that crowd.
We do, but we're not going to single them out.
No, 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 be nice to everyone.
Maybe in the podcast.
I'm going to shut up and take this on.
Okay, so basically, I had been on as my first ever interview guest, and it was an hour of talking about his band. So here he is. Thank you so much for coming back.
It's great to be back here.
And so since we dropped that first episode of the podcast on Friday, you've released a new song.
Released one of the singles called To the Years. So it's out there. Now we have two songs that are out on the internet.
Which is exciting.
Yeah, it is exciting.
And you got an EP coming out at the end of the month.
That's correct. Yeah, you can order it now. Pre-orders are available. You can get a little sneak peek of it. And then it drops on the 31st.
Okay. So you told me some really interesting things about this song and where it came from for you. Well, first in the podcast, we talked about your influences from Bach to Paul Simon to Blake Mills, Volcano Choir. So that good stuff is all online. And I can tell the listening audience where to find that later. But I want you to talk about this song, To the Years. Why did you come up with this title specifically? And where did the rest of the song kind of come? Because we're playing the radio debut of this song in just
first
a second.
Radio debut that I'm aware of.
Right, exactly. So let's hear it.
Yeah, well, it kind of comes from a few different places. Lyrically, it comes from, well, I was reading the T.S. Eliot poem, The Wasteland, and he's kind of talking about the demise of the world from his perspective, and it just seemed, you know, 100 years ago, it seems there's some similarities, and I guess I could really understand and sympathize with where he was coming from. And so some of the lyrics, like in the verses, are just kind of a rumination on that first opening kind of famous line where he's talking about the lilies being like grown from the ground and how it's actually not a good thing. It's sad that they're being brought to life from the lilies. So the first line is like talking about burying a car. So kind of something that's a little more contemporary, burying a car in the yard. And then and also I was mentioned in the podcast when I had begun working on the song, it was actually like 4 or 5 years ago. I'm not sure, Rick, if you ever remembered the phrase YOLO.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. And I just thought it was such a really stupid phrase because I wanted to live for a long time. And so that's what the chorus is kind of about. Or I wouldn't say about, but that's where those lyrics are coming from.
So kind of the appreciate your life.
Yeah.
To the years.
Yeah,
cheers
exactly.
To the years.
Yeah.
Cool. I love that. So backing up a little bit. Tell me about Mateus, the chemical makeup thereof. It started as kind of just a thing that was ruminating in your mind for a couple years, which I think everybody can relate to an idea, but you actually followed through on it. So let's hear about that.
Yeah, well, when I was studying contemporary classical composition in school, but I was also really into kind of pop music and indie bands, and I just had this idea to kind of have a larger band that would play clubs and play more pop-oriented tunes, but put a contemporary or classical symphonic twist on it, or not even a twist, but just kind of bring some elements that that are a little more artistic. And I was just never able to execute it. I had a few different fits and starts with it, and then I just left another band, and I just said, you know, screw it. I'm going to get 9 of my friends together, and we're going to do this band. And that's essentially how it started, and it's been really great since. You know, that first show, the whole idea was we're just going to play like these songs that I've written, and if it's awesome, great, and if it's not awesome, we just did one show and it was a good time, and I think everyone really enjoyed it, and we decided to pursue it a little more seriously since then.
And you had just been rehearsing like for one day.
That's right.
That's like something that we need to really emphasize. It was because part of your band's from up in Minnesota. So.
Yeah, and also as you had mentioned earlier, Rick, there's only one weak link in the band. No, I'm just kidding. And there are 9 really outstanding musicians, and they're all professional musicians. They're all touring, and they're doing a lot of things. So just scheduling-wise,
must be a nightmare.
It really is. Good thing there's an app for that. So use Doodle.
Really?
Yeah, Doodle and Slack and everything to do crazy scheduling things. But yeah, for our first show, I sent out music. We had a few rehearsals with like smaller groups of the band, but we really didn't get together until that day of the gig. We did like a dress rehearsal, at the studio where we recorded the EP over at Shirk Studio. So we just did like 2 hours of rehearsal for the first time and then went and played the show.
Well, hey, sounds kind of like putting together live radio.
Well, but also, hey, the collective aesthetic mm-hmm. of that many people is tough to grab. I mean, yeah. What was the general reaction after it?
I think everyone was maybe not surprised, but they were like, wow, this is something there. And these are all, I mean, some of the players, you know, this is just, I think that first gig was just like, all right, I got the music. I'm just going to show up and play. And we just had a really good time, and I think we all bought into what was going on.
That's pretty amazing.
Yeah, I think so. And it's a testament to just the character of everyone in the band.
Well, to a shared aesthetic of some kind.
Exactly.
You want to hear this?
Yeah.
Lise, what do you think? It's your show.
I think it's great.
Now, where can they listen to the entire podcast, Lise?
The entire podcast is available on SoundCloud right now, so it's SoundCloud.com/LiseFM podcast, LiseFM podcast, and you can listen to episodes 1 and 2. And I'll post that on the WGN.
Yeah,
radio
put it on our site.
I'm gonna
pleasure to meet you. I really like
you
your
too.
Music so far.
Thanks so much.
I've got much more to hear.
There are two more songs, so it can go
much
downhill.
Okay, well that's good. It's not like a whole album. Uh-huh. It's not like the White Album or something.
No, that's.
But
the
I also
next
admire
album.
your you know the sort of eclectic nature of your influences too. That's very intriguing.
Yeah.
Thank you. Lise is ready. Here you go, ladies and gentlemen. Introduce us, Ben.
This tune is called To the Ears, and it's the radio premiere.
What you steal from me.
To the years from Mateus, Chicago band, up and coming and going places.
Thanks to you. Thanks yes. to you, Lise.
Okay. Thanks
I will
to,
give you credit.
Thanks then to
it's, it's good music.
Everybody.
It's good music,
thank
Lise.
You.
Thanks for your discovery.
Oh, thank
and
you
keep
for
us, keep
letting
the listeners.
Me,
oh, don't be silly. Keep the listeners posted, too.
Absolutely.
Man. And then come see me at the Hideout.
Yes.
There you go. Ben, it's a pleasure to meet you. Keep at
thank
it,
thank you for
it's
having
a tough,
me.
It's a tough world out there, but you've got talent.
Oh,
man, and talent,
thank you.
I'm an old, you know, sort of hippie philosophy that talent will out, man.
I hope so.
Talent
hope
will
so.
Out.
Really
great to
quick,
meet you.
Great to meet
tell
you.
Tell us about your show.
Yeah.
At the end of the month.
May 31st, Empty Bottle. It's a Wednesday night. There are three bands releasing records, so it's gonna be a real nice night, a hoedown, you might say.
Lise, can you put all this information on the website?
I absolutely
fantastic.
Will.
Fantastic.
Thank you.
Awesome. A great find, honey. A great find. A great find. That's Joan Baez singing one of Bob Dylan's best songs. I was fascinated when a friend of mine got in touch with me to tell me about a company celebrating its 100th anniversary. That happens occasionally, but the fact that this company is now into its fourth generation of family ownership and the fact that it makes clocks was so intriguing to me that I asked her to see if Jason Matheson would come on, the newly named president of the Chicago Clock Company, would come on the radio to talk about it. Jason, here you are.
Hi.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm good. This is an amazing, in many ways, an amazing story to me because you think of, and tell me I'm wrong, you now have, and I guess I just missed, you had a big, big 100th anniversary party at your four locations, didn't you?
Yeah, we sure did. We had one at each of our locations, and it really went off very nicely.
Let me ask you, one of the things that intrigues me so much is we live in this, you know, increasingly high-tech age where you think, well, I can tell what time it is from my iPhone or my iPad or my i-something. The fact that you guys are still in what I consider thriving business mode, how do you figure that? It cannot simply be a nostalgic thing, because I've looked at your website and some of your clocks are magnificent. What is it? Is it that clocks have now become, in a sense, pieces of art rather than utilitarian items? What do you think it is?
Oh, absolutely. Definitely pieces of art. But there's also the mechanical aspect of it. There's quite a few clocks that are still available in key wound mechanical, German movement, that type of thing. And it's one of the last few things in our society that still is mechanical. So they're interesting. They're very intricate, and something for you to look at, something to pass on to your as an heirloom, pass on your family members. So it's just kind of a neat thing. And we do quite a bit of service on the clocks, and it's amazing. People bring them in. They've had them for wedding presents and different types of gift items. They bring them in like a baby. They're wrapped up, and it's kind of a neat thing.
Oh, that is a neat thing. How old are you?
I'm 49.
All right. How did you get it? Is it your great-grandfather who started the business?
Yes, it is.
And
yes,
he came here. He was a German immigrant who, as far as I know, went kind of door-to-door selling clocks. Is that right?
Well, he's door-to-door clock repairer.
Oh.
So that's how that started, yes.
Wow. What a fascinating, fascinating life. He was a clockmaker. Was he a clockmaker in Germany or a clock? And is there a difference between being a clockmaker and a clock repairer? I suppose if you know how to repair one, you know how to make one, right?
Yes, and they do consider service technician, what we call service technicians today, they did consider them clock makers at that time and watchmakers as well. But they're really the people that service the clocks.
And so he was sort of a traveling repairman in Chicago. When did When did, if you know, and I'm sure you do, because if you're a 100-year-old family-owned business, you've got to have some serious history in your genes, that he then decided to open a shop? Is that how it happened?
Yes. Yes. That's when my grandfather got involved. And they had some shops that were, you know, in the city, of course.
Sure.
And so that's kind of how that progressed.
But and then the company grew. There must have been Jason Matheson, the new company president, newly named of Chicago Clock Company. There must have been serious competition early on. Am I wrong about that?
Yeah, there was, they did have some pretty significant contracts with some major manufacturers. That they did all of their warranty work, and so that's really how they kind of, you know, got on the map.
Yeah,
and
they must have also, in looking at your website, I think it is, and I hope you agree, is absolutely fascinating. Not just the various styles of clocks, but the prices of clocks and the intricacy of clocks. And as I said before, I've now started to think of clocks in a new way. I think of them now as pieces of art. Now, initially, in your grandfather and great-grandfather's time, most people had clocks in their homes because they needed to basically know what time it was, right?
Oh, absolutely. They were very utilitarian at the time. And, so that's kind of how it's kind of progressed. And they've become more stylish and... they've become where it really fits into the home. So,
and would the Chicago Clock Company sell? Would they design their own clocks, or did they sell various? There must have been, you know, my God, there must have been dozens of manufacturers and companies making clocks around the country, right?
Oh, absolutely. Currently, we sell over 200 different brands of clocks that are still in, you know, production.
Is that right?
So, yeah.
Wow. Does that, well, it can't amaze you. You're in the business, but are you surprised that it amazes me?
You know, I think I am a little bit surprised it amazes you, but yeah. I also can understand that it amazes you because it's, you know, when you come into the shop, you don't really look at it. You just look at all the different things, all the different clocks that are there. And you don't realize how many different manufacturers are involved in that.
Yeah, yeah. Let me ask you, Jason Matheson, you have four stores now. You have a store in Palatine, one in Orland Park. Well, I know the one in Water Tower Place and another one in Clarendon Hills. When someone walks in for the, and I know you've probably done your portion of on-the-floor salesmanship too, when... Describe to me someone coming in to who purchases a clock for the first time. I mean, a very nice clock, not just, I know you have some, you know, like Mickey Mouse clocks and some sort of fun clocks, let's say.
Yeah,
but you do have some very stylish clocks. Describe to me the kind of person who comes into one of your stores to buy a clock for the first time. Why are they doing it? Who are they, and why are they doing it?
Well, you know, and that's a very good question. There's two different types of buyers that come in, and there's one that is that's looking for just something to fill a space in their home,
mm-hmm.
and then there's the customer that is looking for something that they're going to keep and pass on the generations. So. They also may be the customer that grew up with a grandfather clock or a very fine clock, and they remember the chimes, and they're finally at a point in time in their life where they can, where they're ready to purchase one.
Yeah.
So a lot of different types of customers, but I'm definitely seeing a younger crowd come in because they grew up with them.
That's so interesting. We got to take a little break. Can you stay on for a few more minutes?
Absolutely.
This is Joseph Matheson. He's the. When did you get named president of the Chicago Clock Company? How long ago?
That was about 6 months ago.
Oh wow, you're really new to the job. So you take your father's retired now, taking it easy, or are they still working there?
Well, he is semi-retired.
Okay, good. Now the burden is on you, Jason. The burden's on you. You can go to the website, which is chicagoclock.com, and you will be amazed. It's unlike any website I can remember seeing. It's like looking at an art gallery. So stay tuned. We'll carry on and talk more about clocks and a 100-year-old company celebrating its 100th anniversary this year. First, I'll tell you to celebrate your love for literature with Al Franken, Amy Dickinson, and Heather Ann Thompson. Visit PrintersRowLitFest.org for tickets. We'll be right back. Joan Baez and Bob Dylan accompanying me, Rick Kogan, on the radio today, and I'm talking to Jason Matheson, who runs a fascinating company, the Chicago Clock Company, with four outlets in the Chicagoland area. And we've just been talking, he's the fourth generation, he just newly named president of the company. Jason, when you were growing up, you know, obviously you had clocks in your home, but did you grow up and go to college with the notion of entering the family business, or did you toy with some other career? I mean, it sounds like a very cool business, but did you toy with any other career before jumping in?
You know, I did. Yeah. I certainly did when I was in college, but, you know, it was in my blood, so it just kind of came naturally to me. So
you must have interesting memories of hanging around the shop with even your grandfather and watching him. You know, there's something about a mechanical instrument, which is certainly what a clock is, that is unbelievably intriguing to, especially as we live in this, as I said, there's a good downside and an upside to the high-tech age. You know, I couldn't repair, I wouldn't know what to do if my iPhone broke. Do you know what I mean? And the insides just look like a bunch of, you know, science fiction-like things. But don't you find and think, and I think one of the appeals of the clock is the intricacy of the machinery?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And one of my fondest memories is, you know, when I was much younger, is watching my grandfather on his workbench, and there was all these parts. And amazingly, it would look like a big pile of parts, eventually ended up in a clock, and it was running at the end of the day. And that was always pretty amazing to me.
Well, it is like, I guess it's like a kind of magic or something. How good are you yourself? I don't think people should come in and say, hey, I want to see Jason Matheson fix my clock. Are you a pretty adept, could you repair a clock?
Yes, I can.
Could you build one from scratch?
You know, that is not what we do, and yeah. That, you know, it's a whole different part of the business, very
sure.
Interesting as well, but no, we're more on the service end of it, so we'll service something that's already been, you know, produced and in need of repair.
Now, I saw on your website, and people can go to your website at chicagoclock.com and see a number of different kinds of clocks. If someone, and I think you're being very good about this, Jason Matheson, kind of being intriguing for someone who may never have thought of having a clock in their home, how should someone start if I obviously just walk in one of your stores and look around would be the best way to start, but if someone wanted to sort of explore the world of clocks with a purchase, what would you suggest? Something modern or something? I would suggest, I'm not in the business, something old or that looked old.
Well, and that, you know, that's going to be one of the questions that we're going to ask when they do come into the shop. We want to know, you know, what type of decor they have. Are they do they lean more towards modern? Well, we have a lot of clocks that are, you know, that lean towards modern, or are they looking traditional? You know, we have, you know, nearly 1,000 clocks on display. We're going to find something that is going to fit the decor.
Wow. And the price range is pretty, to me, pretty striking. I mean, I suppose someone can spend as much as they have on a clock. That is possible, is it not?
Absolutely. Yeah, sure. But there is, you know, there's many clocks in what almost everybody would consider a very affordable range. And, you know, we try and hit, you know, what is going to fit in anybody's budget.
Sure. What about technology? How has technology changed your business? Because I am drawn, when I think clock, I think old. But I'm sure the mechanics of them, there are some that might be relatively high tech compared to the a clock made 70 years ago. Is that true or not?
Absolutely. Yes, absolutely. There's going to be, you know, even right now, there's quite a few clocks that have Bluetooth technology incorporated into them. So you can, you know, hang a wall clock up in one of your, in a living room, and you can have, you know, your music right off your phone playing, you know, through the clock.
That's wild. That's wild. What about, I know you don't deal with this with watches, but the world of clocks and watches have fascinated me. Is the watch business doing okay in light of, you know, the technology of everybody having a phone now? Or is that, I think that's, you know, I think there's something that people are drawn to, not only clocks, but watches as a kind of, not an old-fashioned kind of thing, and not a nostalgic kind of thing, but a sort of something about the craftsmanship of both of them that appeals to people more so than ever. Do you think so or no?
I do think so. And we do also carry, and we do sell watches, and we also service watches, which is a much smaller part of our business, but we definitely are involved in it. And it is when a clock is a piece of decor for your home, a watch is an accessory for, you know,
your body,
your lifestyle.
Do you wear a watch?
Oh, absolutely.
What kind? If you can tell me.
I wear one of our brands, which is Citizen.
And how many clocks do you have in your home?
I have probably about 15.
15? So you know what time it is no matter where you turn, right? Every time.
I do.
Jason, you sound like you're pretty passionate about your job. As president, do you get to each one of the stores, and are you kind of try to be hands-on and talk to people in the stores and see what they're interested in and stuff, or are you mostly concerned with the business end of the whole thing?
Both. I do try and make each and every one of the stores at least once per week. And I usually spend the entire day there. So I will work with the customers that I am the salesperson that day. Yeah. So that I know, you know, what they're looking for.
Yeah.
So every store has its own personalities.
How interesting. I'm sure the Water Tower store is a pretty interesting place, because that's got to have a lot of people just walking in just to see what's in there, right? That's got to be the liveliest of the bunch, right?
Oh, yes. Yeah, yes. Well, and being Water Tower Place, it's definitely a lot of tourism there. So, you know, we see people from all parts of the world.
Jason Matheson, it's been a pleasure to talk to you. I'm going to have to come in and meet you one day and see what's up in these stores. It is my pleasure. The Chicago Clock Company recently, just last couple of weeks, celebrated its 100th anniversary. What do you think your great-grandfather would make, Conrad Utrecht, who came here and sort of went door-to-door repairing watches? He was from Germany. He was a clock repairman. I know it's impossible to say what he would think. He'd be freaked out by a quarter pounder or something, but he'd obviously be proud and kind of amazed that you were the fourth generation of the family running this. What would he think? Would he be flabbergasted at how clocks are made now? Or would he say, well, of course, this is what they should be? What do you think?
Oh, I think a little bit of both. And, you know, the old world charm of the clocks that he was working on can still be had.
Yeah.
So, you know, that part hasn't changed. What he would be very amazed at is probably the technology part, the fact that you could play the fact that your phone can play music through a clock. That would probably amaze him.
I bet it would. I bet he'd be awfully, awfully proud, though, Jason. It's great to meet you over the telephone, and continued success. You can have a look, and the website is, I think the website is unbelievably cool, ChicagoClock.com. Have a look and visit one of the four different stores. How long have these stores all been in operation? What's your oldest location? There's one in Palatine, Orland Park, in Water Tower Place in Chicago, and Clarendon Hills. Which one is the oldest one?
Palatine is the oldest.
Yeah.
That's what we've had. We've been there since 1972.
Oh, wow. Well, congratulations. It is a family-owned business since 1917, which is something of a miracle in itself. Jason, I hope to meet you one day. Jason Matheson, the newly named president of the Chicago Clock Company. So take care. Thanks for coming on.
All right. Thanks, Richard.
Okay,
really,
my pleasure.
It.
My pleasure. Fascinating. A real slice of old Chicago. Coming in the next half hour is a frequent guest of mine, the prolific William Hazelgrove, who has written another fascinating book. The last one was about Edith Wilson, the wife of Woodrow Wilson, who kind of took over his presidency. This one is called Forging a President, How the Wild West Created Teddy Roosevelt. It is fascinating on every single page. So stay tuned. And Bill's a really good guy, too, and he comes in here at 10:30 on a Sunday night, which is a great credit to him.
In our arms on Independence Day.
That's Joan Baez singing the words of her former lover, Bob Dylan. William Hazelgrove and I have chatted on the radio a number of times, most recently about Edith Wilson, the remarkable wife of Woodrow Wilson, who actually became kind of the president of the United States when her husband was felled by a very severe stroke. And when he was on, he was telling me about this. His next book, not only is he a great guy, he's prolific, too. He told me about it. I've got a book about Teddy Roosevelt. And I'm saying, okay, well, you know, what else is there? You know, he was a president. And the literature of any president, Bill, as you well know, fills bookshelves.
Right.
This one, however, takes a very specific look at the title is Forging a President. The subtitle is How the Wild West Created Teddy Roosevelt. I found this utterly compelling. Yes, because the image of Teddy Roosevelt is rough rider, tough guy.
Right.
That is hard. He's a self-made tough guy. Created.
Yeah.
He was a... Describe Teddy Roosevelt as a young man, a child young man.
Sickly, asthmatic, horrible digestive problems. We would call it Crohn's disease today. Couldn't sleep. Suffer from melancholia, which we would call depression today. The doctors didn't think he would make it to adulthood. And, you know, as we were discussing before, what his father would do was literally take him out in Manhattan, have him hang off the side of the carriage, and then ride like the wind and force air into his lungs. You know, they didn't have any inhalers. They had no antispasmodics to open him up. He'd give him coffee, whiskey, cocaine, anything he could get his hands on to stop these spasms. And none of it really helped him.
Well, as you write in here, I mean, the truth is that Teddy Roosevelt became what he was not, a cowboy through sheer will. When he first came out west, he was a sickly, as you just said, weak young man who suffered so much from asthma that when he was a boy, and this is such a vivid image, his father would take him on fast buggy rides just to force air into his lungs. There's a certain desperation in that act.
Oh, yeah.
A certain desperation there. When did he first go out west?
Okay, so in 1883, life's gotten really good for Teddy. He's an assemblyman in Albany. All of a sudden, he gets a telegram. His wife's having a baby, says everything's great. He gets a second telegram saying, come home immediately. Your wife is gravely ill. He goes home. There's this horrible fog. Takes him a long time to get back to Manhattan. He gets back there. Not only is his wife gravely ill, his mother. So his wife is dying from Bright's disease, his mother from typhoid fever. They die on the same day in 1883. Teddy Roosevelt puts an X there in his diary. He says, the light has gone out of my life. 3 months later, he goes west. I'm talking west to the Dakota Territories. It's 1883. The frontier will be closed in 1890. This is still the Wild West. Geronimo's out there. Billy the Kid was just killed 2 years before. And he goes without a return date.
Yeah, I know. I know. That's chapter three. And that is such a haunting, haunting title for The Day the Light Went Out.
Right.
He had no plans to come back, did he?
No, he really was devastated. And, you know,
well, understandably.
Right, exactly. I mean, people were afraid for his sanity. And, you know, a lot of historians have sort of skipped over this part of his life and sort of gone to the vigorous Teddy Roosevelt right away. But this is not who went out west. Who went out west was a severely distraught young man who was weak, asthmatic, and going to an alien place.
He wore glasses. He was four eyes. He was bullied.
The whole notion.
What amazes me, Bill, and you always wind up sort of finding these great historical tracks that others have ignored for some reason.
Right.
This is as compelling a story about Teddy Roosevelt as San Juan Hill.
Absolutely.
Bull Moose Party and everything else.
Absolutely, because it's my thesis, and, you know, we'll go to the title, Origin of President. It's my thesis that the West created Teddy Roosevelt. Teddy Roosevelt was created out there in the Badlands. We'll talk about what the Badlands were about, but he was created in the Badlands in the 3 years he was out there, and he came back with that West in him, that swagger, and it meshed the country in the early 20th century, became the American century. And that's really who Teddy Roosevelt is. And so he really is that cowboy.
But there's also in him, and you do a great job of sort of getting at it, there is a, it's not resilience, but there is a, he's questing.
Yes.
He is seeking.
Existential journey. Yep. Absolutely. He goes out into the balance. What's the first thing he does? He goes to the balance, which, we'll talk about the balance. Negative 40 in the winter, 120 in the summer.
And he's fascinated by that.
It mirrors his insides. There's lignite fires, which are basically sulfur fires burning out there, okay? So when you get there, you see these huge geologic contortions with these fires burning, you know, in the twilight. This appeals to him. You know, Custer called it hell with the fires out. He hated it.
Yeah.
You know, everybody else would hate this place. Teddy Roosevelt loves it. He loves it because it mirrors what's going on inside him. And you're right. This is very existential for him.
He has some money. I mean, he is not, he ain't broke.
Right, exactly. Which allows him, and people rightly point this out, allows him to do these things. He does go west. Now, fair enough. And when the frontier, we don't have a frontier, but the frontier allowed people in the east, when their life disintegrated, to go west and recreate themselves. We can't do that as much now, but people would go and become somebody else, which Teddy Roosevelt uses the West to do. He was also able, though, to plunk down $14,000 on a log, give it to two guys to get into the cattle business, which he does. And, of course, in that famous scene, he gives them the money, and which is about $100,000 today, and they say, do you need a receipt? He says, no, that's okay.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you know, yes, he had money. And, by the way, he was a terrible businessman. We'll get to that in a little bit, too. But, yes, he jumps into the cattle business. He has no idea what he's doing. Considered four eyes. His buckskin coat is from Brooks Brothers.
Yeah.
They think he's a joke. They think he's a fop from the East, a dude. They call him this dude. And, of course, what's the first thing that happens to him? He's out looking for horses. Five Indians ride up on him with Winchesters over the head. Teddy Roosevelt drops down, takes out his Winchester, puts it across the pommel of his saddle, and faces him down. They come up and say, no, no, we're friendly. He says, stay right there. Then they curse at him. He says, well, I knew they knew English then.
Yeah.
And then he backs him off and he gets back. But, you know, again, this is this little guy who's doing this. And you wonder, where does this grit come from? Where does this come from?
Do you think in some way he went out there, because he seems courageous beyond all reason.
Yes.
Do you think there's any sort of death wish kind of thing going on there?
Yes.
I'm sorry to ask such a deep question. I'm so
incredibly
taken with this story.
Well, because you read it, and so you know all the things that happened to him.
Yeah.
It would have killed anybody else. And I started to believe in destiny because he is obviously destined for something greater because he didn't die.
Exactly.
But I think he did do that. He had a very interesting thing he said. He said, black care rarely sits close to the rider who rides fast enough. Well, what's that mean? It means if you're doing extreme things and going as fast as you can, then this melancholia, this horrible grief will not bother you. And Teddy, in his whole life, would do this. After terrible tragedy, he'd go do some incredibly excruciating physical thing that would almost kill him.
Like the shooting.
Like the shooting.
Talk about that for a second.
Okay, right, exactly. Okay, so he goes into, he's out again looking for horses. He goes to a town called Mingusville. And Mingusville, this is dirty little western town, goes down to look for a place to sleep. He goes in, of course, there's a bad guy in there shooting up the place. And Teddy goes and sits behind the stove, thinking about, he'll let it pass. The guy comes over, stands over him and says, Four Eyes is buying for the house. Teddy Roosevelt ignores him. He said, I said Four Eyes is buying for the house. Teddy Roosevelt says, okay, if I must, I must. Gets up, cold cocks him right, left, knocks the guy out. His stock starts to rise in the West. His legend. People start to say, well, maybe this isn't just some foppy guy from the East. Maybe there's some grit in this man. And in the West, you're as good as your word.
Yeah. And wow, that's the chapter, The Newly Minted Cowboy. We are talking with William Hazelgrim about his latest book, Forging a President and How the Wild West Created Teddy Roosevelt. Fascinating story. We got to take a commercial break and come back. I want to read one thing before, just to your point about how he confronted everything. When he died, Mr. Roosevelt, on January 6, 1919, after a blood clot moved into his lungs at 60, Woodrow Wilson's vice president, who was a very strange guy,
yes,
as you have taught me,
yes,
as a Grove, said this, summed up Roosevelt's death this way, quote, death had to take Roosevelt sleeping. If he had been awake, there would have been a fight. That's a great quote. We'll be right back. John Baez and Bob Dylan, there's a team, and William Hazelgrove and Teddy Roosevelt is another team. Bill's written Forging the President, How the Wild West Created Teddy Roosevelt. It is an adventure tale.
It is.
Pure and simple, Bill, it's an adventure tale. How did you come upon this? I mean, I know you've been researching a number of books. How did this grab you so?
I was reading Edmund Morris's trilogy on Teddy Roosevelt, and I stumbled on the part where his wife and mother died. I thought, my God, what a tragedy. And then the parts where, you know, he was so sickly. And then he goes west. And I thought, well, here it is. Here's the redemption story. Here's what created Teddy Roosevelt. You know, and when I write something, I'm thesis-driven, you know, first
sure.
woman president. So to me, it was like, well, this is what created Teddy Roosevelt. You know, this is what created this incredible, vigorous, swaggering cowboy who, by the way, when he did become president, they said, oh, my God, that cowboy is now president.
Yeah.
And they were right.
Yeah.
You know, he would go swim in the Potomac every day, ride his horse in. But so that's what made me say, I'm going to hone in on this because I want to know what happened out there in those 3 years in the Badlands that created Teddy Roosevelt.
What surprised you about your research?
Two things. One is that he was so sick that they said his cowhand said that you could span his waist with your two hands sometimes because of the Crohn's disease he had. He had a horrible Crohn's disease. And then the second thing would be the things that would have killed anybody else. You know, he was on a roundup, and a roundup is basically where you're trying to pull on the cattle. Well, the cattle stampeded at night. So Teddy Roosevelt jumps on his horse. He's riding full out. And this is very treacherous because there's gullies and cliffs.
Oh, yeah.
Well, he goes right off a cliff with his horse down into the Little Missouri River. The horse flips over. Teddy Roosevelt falls off. They both land in the river. The horse lands next to him, which, you know, again, would have killed him if it fell on him. But most people would say, okay, I've had enough. Teddy Roosevelt gets back on the horse and continues on the roundup for 16 hours. Again, this is a guy who's destined for something greater, that, you know, because he did not get killed out.
I'll give you an alternative theory. He's destined for something greater, or he's really mentally disturbed.
Yes. You know, you bring that up, but some people thought Roosevelt was crazy. When his first wife, Alice, would not marry him at Harvard, he went into the woods at night and wouldn't come out. He would take walks, long walks, and wouldn't come out. Finally, a family friend came out to see him and said, "You've got to stop this. You know, this is getting really." And he also ordered dueling pistols in case somebody else tried to take her from him. So Teddy Roosevelt had a different side to him, let's say. You know, and it was a bit murderous. You know, he was a killer of animals, and then later, of course, when San Juan Hill and Charge That Hill, he proved he could kill humans pretty well too.
But I love the title of this book, Forging, because it implies the strength of forged metal.
Right.
He came out of the West, out of this portion of the West, as a great admirer of the West for a number of things, such as...
Right. For the fact that you would have to be self-reliant. And, you know, he really came to know the common man. He was from a patrician family.
Oh, my God, absolutely.
But everybody called him Mr. Roosevelt, even though there were men twice his age, okay? But he started to, you know, he started to garner the respect of these men, and he respected these men. He respected the cowboy because he was self-reliant, and their word was the word. You know, there's a scene where this cowboy is branding this cattle, and Roosevelt said, "Why are you putting my brand on that cattle?" And he goes, "Well, boss, I know my job." And he said, "But that's Lang's cattle. That's the other outfit." And the cowboy says, "I know." And Roosevelt says, "Get your stuff and get out. If you'll steal from him, you'll steal from me." So he had this iron sort of line in the sand, which also is when he became a sheriff, an unofficial sheriff.
Right.
He gets
his
boat gets stolen in the Little Missouri River. Most people would say, "My boat got stolen." Roosevelt builds a boat in the winter, goes down after these guys 3 days, chasing them. With some Tolstoy, of course, to read along the way. Catches him, gets a drop on him, then takes him 7 days to a sheriff, gets $35 for bringing him in.
Yeah, it's an astonishing thing. I can see why you got hooked on this. And I also sense your excitement even now. It's a very exciting read.
Yeah, it is.
Because it reads like a movie.
I wrote, you know, and we'll talk a little bit about my method on some of these books. You know, as you know, I wrote 10 novels before.
Sure.
So what I do is I bring scenes to the history where I recreate them. And so it's experiential history, because I believe you have to experience. And at the end, you're going to say to yourself, "Wow, this West did or did not create him." I'm not going to tell you that. You're going to go through all these experiences saying that he is Wilson. You'll get to the end and say, "Well, she was or was not the president." But I'm going to let you make that decision.
Right, 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 right.
The journey, not the destination.
Yeah, I think she was the president.
Absolutely.
That book was a stunner, too.
Yeah,
How did this whole Western adventure further inform Roosevelt the politician?
Ah, great question. Well, here's a another great scene with Teddy. I have to tell this one. 1912, he's running against Wilson, starts the Bull Moose Party, splits off from Republicans. He's in Milwaukee to give a speech. A guy named Charles Schrank comes up on him, shoots him in the chest.
This is an amazing story.
Right.
Listen to this closely, ladies and gentlemen. Yeah.
Shoots him in the chest. The bullet goes through his glasses case and his folded speech, lodges in his rib. Roosevelt takes out his handkerchief, checks his mouth to see if his lungs are bleeding. They aren't. And the people around him say, "You've got to go to the hospital." He says, "Absolutely not. I came to give a speech. I'm going to go give a speech." Speaks for 90 minutes in Milwaukee. Then he gets from there, changes his shirt, gets on a train to Chicago, and sleeps like a baby the whole way. And in the morning goes to the hospital where they go, "We can't take this bullet out. You're going to have it for the rest of your life."
That is an amazing.
And of course, he hit the famous quote. He said, "It takes more than a bullet to stop a bull moose."
Yeah.
But that man, and, you know, and as you know, I lead off in the book with that scene.
Oh,
because
yeah.
It's my contention. That man who stood up there for 90 minutes was born in the West.
Mm. Mm. What are you working on now?
I actually have a book coming out.
this is why I love Ben Bill. But not only is he, it's very hard, ladies and gentlemen, in this publishing environment to continue to publish, because the publishing environment these days is wicked,
brutal.
Nasty, brutal, mean, unrelenting.
Venal.
Yeah, venal. Yes, every bad word you could think of. But Bill, I think the reason you are able to write nonfiction books as compelling as you are is you're a novelist.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And so
you don't get bogged down. You're a storyteller.
I'm a storyteller. And, you know, when I go through all the secondary sources and the primary sources, I'm looking for those stories because that tells the tale.
Yep.
That tells the tale. You know, I don't mind dry history, but it doesn't work in telling a dramatic tale. So anyway, the book that will be out in the fall is this fall.
Good Lord.
I know. It's ridiculous. I'm an anomaly. It's something strange. But you know what? I've been doing this my whole life. So it's like, you know, and honestly, writing narrative nonfiction is easier for me than writing fiction. I don't have to create the whole thing. The story's there.
Yeah.
Al Capone in the 1933 World's Fair is basically the one coming out in the fall. And it's basically how the Chicago, through an organization called the Secret Six, not Elliot Ness, got rid of Capone because they needed to get rid of him for this 33 fair that occurred in the worst year of the Great Depression.
See, that's just, how'd you find that story?
I was snooping around, reading about Al Capone, and I loved Devil in the White City.
Yeah, sure.
And then all of a sudden I realized, oh my God, they did it again 40 years later. And that's how I start the book, 40 years later. And so 40 years later, they do the exact same thing, except this time it's called A Century of Progress, and Chicago is broke. Chicago has no money, and people are like, you're crazy to put on this fair. You're absolutely crazy. Also, you just had the St. Valentine's Day Massacre. Right. Like, nobody's going to come to a fair here. Everybody thinks people are running with the Thompsons, and they were right. So the big guns in Chicago got together and formed called the Secret Six. They were six Chicago millionaires who got together and funded a secret police force to get rid of Capone, and they did.
It's a great story.
It is.
That's a great, great story.
And I tell the story of building this fair that's incredible. It was like another city on the lakefront.
That's an amazing thing. That is an underreported fair.
Very underreported.
The Century of Progress. Why do you I guess because the Columbian Exposition just overshadows everything.
Yeah, that was so big. And also it was during the Great Depression.
Right.
But it was this amazing success. And it was all privately funded. Every bit of it. None of it came from the government because nobody had any money.
Yeah.
So the $200 million they needed to get off the ground, they funded it here
in
Chicago.
Isn't that where Mike Todd, the famous, you haven't finished the book, but I think that's where Mike Todd met Gypsy Rose Lee.
That's right. And, of course, one of the other central characters is Sally Rand.
Of course, Sally Rand and her fan dance.
Who rides into the fair on the first night on a horse naked. So,
Lady Godiva.
You got to love it.
Lady Godiva. Bill, you love your life, don't you?
Yes. Well,
All right. We've been talking about Bill's latest book, and in the fall we'll talk about his next book, Forging a President, How the Wild West Created Teddy Roosevelt. It is really a grand, grand adventure tale. And it tells you more about, it's a real American story, too.
It is. Redemption. We love people who fall off the horse, not to overuse an analogy, but who fall off the horse and get back on and go, I'm going to gallop this way and keep going. And that's Teddy. And Teddy would often quote, he said two interesting things. He said, the romance of my life began here when going to the Badlands. And he said, I could have never been president if I hadn't gone to the Badlands and gone west. So, he really kept reinventing himself that way. He went out there and reinvented himself. But he kept going on. And he also had another quote where he said, I'm for the man in the ring. I'm not for the man on the sidelines. I'm for the man that throws his hat in the ring, win or lose.
He's a remarkable character. William Hazelgrove is the author. Bill's got a nice website, William Hazelgrove. That's William. And then HAZELGROVE.com. You can get all of his books. Another one coming out in the fall, and he will be here.
Absolutely.
To talk about it, Bill. It's always great to see you, and congratulations again. Your last one was great. This one's great. You've got a niche here, and I think this next one about Al Capone and Century of Progress sounds fantastic.
Yeah, that's a fascinating story. That's, as you said, is undertold.
Yeah, you find them. You look at history with a novelist's eye. You come back with that story. So, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
For keeping writing. Lise Graham, thanks for being the greatest producer in the world. Adam Phillips, thanks for being the greatest engineer I've ever known in my life. You people, the greatest audience ever. Goes without saying.